Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we discuss bipolar disorder with us, social worker Jenny Putnam. Hi, Jenny.
Hello.
Psychiatrist Mark Whalick. Morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
And neuroscientist and author Lisa Genova. Her latest book, More or Less Maddie, is focused on bipolar disorder. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Mindy.
So who wants to start and tell us what bipolar disorder is?
I'll start with a sentence. You know, there's this popular book called The Greatest Sentence Ever Written. It's, you know, from the Declaration of Independence. But the greatest sentence ever written for this talk today is that bipolar disorder is common. It's serious. It's highly treatable. And it's a brain disease. However, delayed diagnosis and stigma cost lives. So that's our topic for today, is to at least put out on the table what bipolar is like, how to recognize it, et cetera. But it is common. And, you know, one of the statistics always surprised me. Somebody with bipolar disorder, it's not uncommon for them to go 6 to 10 years, see 5, 10, 20 psychiatrists before they get the correct diagnosis. It's really, it masquerades as depression primarily, it's a very costly illness to people individually, to families who have a relative with the condition. It also is something that begins in young adulthood, like in the late teens or early 20s. So it strikes, so to speak, or becomes symptomatic just when somebody's starting out in their life.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with anything that Dr. Whalick is saying. And yet at the same time, I also feel strongly that the very term bipolar disorder is a disservice to many people who have an unstable mood. I hope that someday, and I believe that someday, hopefully soon, what bipolar disorder will be transformed as a label into a spectrum, a mood spectrum, in the same way that autism has. Mm-hmm. And I also will say that I believe that bipolar disorder is both underdiagnosed and overdiagnosed. We have seen so many people come to us for treatment of depression, you know, in our TMS offices, who have been incorrectly diagnosed as having bipolar disorder. I also believe strongly that when people get clean and sober, we see many people get diagnosed with bipolar disorder during the 6 to 12 months after they get clean. And it's just a complete misunderstanding of what happens to brain chemistry after people stop using drugs. These people should not be diagnosed with bipolar disorder, although they have to be treated symptomatically. Anyway, we'll get into that more. But I've seen, you know, and I'm very interested, of course, in what Lisa has to say, because I'm sure she's done a lot of, you know, research on the subject. But my clinical experience is huge. And I think that the American Psychiatric Association has it all wrong.
Yeah. Lisa, what do you think?
Well, let's just like start with, so folks are on the same page, like, what is bipolar disorder? Because like, it's loosely used a lot. And like, a lot of times people like will say, if someone's just acting out in a big way, like, oh, she's bipolar. So bipolar disorder, it's a collection of symptoms that describes your brain's impairment in its ability to regulate things like mood, emotion, energy, sleep, and thought. So it can go in a revved up direction where you're not sleeping much and you've got tons of energy and you're talking all the time and you have flight of ideas and your thinking is rapid and your speech is rapid. You might even have delusions where you believe things that aren't real, hallucinations, you hear and see things that aren't real. You behave in a way that it can be reckless and impulsive. The other end is the other direction. These are the two poles, is depression. And so you don't have the energy. You might be sleeping all the time. You your thoughts might also not be based in reality, where you just believe you're worthless and life is not worth living. And so you don't have the energy to shower or to go to class or go to work. So that's a description of it. The statistics tell us that there are about like one in 50 people in the US are diagnosed. So about, I think, 7 million people. But I imagine, on the one hand, John, it's wildly underdiagnosed, because in talking to folks, it takes a level of economic privilege to get to a diagnosis. Like what Mark said, it can take 7 to 10 years on average to get to that diagnosis, in part because if you only have depressive symptoms to begin with, you don't think you have bipolar disorder, you think you have depression. It's not until you have that manic episode that it's unmasked as, oh, this isn't just unipolar depression, this is now bipolar. But often it's just because you aren't getting to the right psychiatrist who can ask you the questions and uncover this. So you end up in an emergency room, or you end up arrested because you're behaving in a way in a public that the police don't identify as a mental health issue. They see like you've just broken a law. And then, in terms of it being overdiagnosed, then maybe it's a cousin, it's a related mood disorder that is diagnosed as bipolar instead of, say, borderline, or some other, or maybe it was just, it's a substance abuse issue. So I would guess that it's underdiagnosed, not overdiagnosed. But we could argue all day on that. But yeah, it's a really tricky disorder to live with, for reasons having to do with stigma, having to do with medications aren't specific, and there's tons of side effects. There's the diagnosis is it's not like getting a blood test and finding out you have heart disease or diabetes. It is a diagnosis of exclusion. So you they we will exclude through scans and blood tests, like, that this isn't due to substances of abuse, that your symptoms aren't due to a brain tumor, et cetera. It is, well, we'll ask you some questions. So it's not based on data in your blood or a scan. It's the absence of data that tell us, like, well, we'll ask you some questions, and if you fit the criteria for what we have described as bipolar disorder in DSM-5, then that's your diagnosis. So it's tricky for folks to sort of, you're getting diagnosed by a physician you've probably never met before, and it's based on a conversation. So this it's a t
Yeah,
it's a
it's really
tough
tricky.
diagnosis to live with.
I want to break down some of the stuff that you've all just said, and the nature of bipolar episodes really can vary a lot between person to person, right? And so, Jonathan, as you mentioned, maybe is it a spectrum, like we could say with autism, that there's a spectrum of symptoms that people would experience having bipolar disorder?
Well, there's a huge spectrum, and there are spectrums within spectrums. So, for example, what I mean by that is that, there's rapid cycling bipolar disorder, where you have people who literally, from hour to hour, can go from being hypomanic or manic with all kinds of delusions of grandeur to collapsing into a pool of just feeling terrible and awful. We have forms of bipolar. What you call mixed episodes. So people can be really irritable and cranky and certainly not happy. And yet that represents one realm of what often is embedded in a bipolar spectrum. I mean, it's just, I mean, that's why I refer to this as an unstable mood disorder, even though mood itself is only one of many variables, as Lisa was saying. There's sleep, there's energy level, there's sex drive. There's just so many appetite. There's so many variables that need to be. I saw a patient just within the last week who was diagnosed with menopause-induced bipolar disorder, a term I had never heard before. I don't know whether it has any legitimacy, but she was diagnosed by an MD psychiatrist with a lot of experience, and it may be the case that the hormonal changes of menopause have certainly resulted in an unstable mood. But as Mark said, bipolar disorder, as we were trained to understand it, typically has its onset in the mid to late teens or early 20s, not in the 50s.
And I'm just curious if this physician was a male or a female who
I
diagnosed
know
her.
I have comments in the
A
works. I
female.
mean,
It
I think that
was a female.
menopause, like adolescence, can look like bipolar disorder, but to lay that on someone because of menopause feels pretty heavy to me.
Well, it was a female, in fact, and it was very
Right,
experienced.
but there's no data to support that label. That's ridiculous, honestly. And so one of the things that we do know, and we do have evidence on and data-based information on, is that changes in your sleep. If you have the underpinnings of bipolar disorder in your brain, and you start to not sleep much, you start to, for any kind of reason, and one of the reasons could be menopause, because one of the symptoms of going through perimenopause and menopause is that you might be up throughout the night with hot flashes and night sweats, and you're losing sleep. And so if you've got an underlying bipolar disorder in weight, and you are starting to go through a period of time for maybe the first time in your life where instead of getting 8 hours a night, you're now getting 4, 3 hours a night, that can be the trigger that causes this. So it's not, oh, you're a woman going through it's not you're menopausal, therefore you are now bipolar. I just want to resist, I don't like that. I'm not I'll fight that one. That's not okay for women to be
I was
called
not
menopausal.
endorsing it. I
No,
was
I
not
know you're not, but we're not
endorsing
going to spread this.
it. As you all are mentioning, this generally comes on late teens, early 20s. But the symptoms, there are symptoms before then, right? That can start anywhere 12, between 12 and 24. What are those symptoms? How would you even see that coming?
I think one symptom is just one aspect is just how stable or how reactive the person's mood is, and do they react out of proportion to some stressor, and exhibit irritability, I think, is one of the early things that can appear and could foretell the development of bipolar, more overt bipolar symptoms.
Moody, irritable. Isn't that almost
Mood.
every teenager on the
Like every teenager, yeah.
planet?
Dramatic overreactivity, I guess, is one way to put it. And sensitivity. So if you find yourself kind of walking around on eggshells, which you have to do with teenagers anyway, but if you find that, that it really is a problem in different environments too, the family environment as well as the school environment. Sometimes these kids will act out like mad, and be unregulated is one of the terms we use at home, but not at school.
And how would you differentiate that from an autism spectrum disorder or
ADHD.
ADHD or regular old hormone changes, brain changes? I mean, I'm always very, very hesitant to diagnose people under 24. I mean, I really just feel like it could be so many things. And I look back, I was saying earlier, my sister is bipolar, and I look back on her behavior as a teenager. And the thing that stands out the most is that she could be so mean, and people would be like, she's so mean. And I would feel like, she's not, though. She's never trying to hurt someone. And I don't know. I feel like a lot of things were going on, and it would have been impossible to diagnose her back then.
What about the we I mean we see I can remember talking to one of the school superintendents who was talking about the number of kids, young kids, that have this bipolar diagnosis. It's possible, but isn't it like extremely rare for like, a young child to.
Yeah, that is rare. I mean, the average age of onset is late teens, early 20s. And like one of the so, what predicts this? There is a genetic component. So if you have a parent or a relative that has bipolar disorder, you have a higher chance of getting bipolar disorder than the general public. It's not definitive. It's not an autosomal dominant sort of situation. Also correlated with it is childhood trauma, childhood abuse, and substance abuse. But being dysregulated is a normal sign of being a teenager. So it's not like, oh my God, my child is so moody and explosive, is bipolar in the waiting. I think that one of the things that leads up to a diagnosis eventually is a lot of times young teenagers are depressed. We see a lot of depression. But the bipolar of it, the mania of it, which is what gets you to a diagnosis of either bipolar 2 or bipolar 1, that's the thing. Like, it's not just like, oh, you're dysregulated in mood, because teenagers are dysregulated in mood. It's, are you revved up? Do you become someone who doesn't need sleep, who interrupts constantly and can't stop talking, is texting and posting to Instagram all night long, and isn't tired? It's not like you stay up and like, oh, I'm exhausted the next day and teenagers need to sleep till noon. No, this teenager would now, no problem. I'm not tired. I'll keep going. And has like grand ideas.
I had one patient who described it. I thought this was beautiful. He described it as you're going through your life and suddenly you're a train and you're on a train track and you're going so fast. It feels so good. And that can go on for days. And then suddenly you recognize that you have gone off the rails.
But you know, I think what Lisa's describing is, you know, again, the kind of classic textbook signs and symptoms that we see with bipolar, typically with an onset mid to late teens, early 20s. Back in the 19 late early 80s, when I was a resident at Mass General, there was a conflict between the pediatric neurology staff and the child psychiatry staff. Child psychiatry staff said there is no such thing as bipolar disorder in childhood, and the pediatric neurology staff was treating kids with lithium who were unstable in their behavior. It was it's interesting. So there's an ongoing, and still now here we are 40 years, literally 40 years later, there's still not entirely agreement among people who study this and see these kids and young adults all day long. There's not necessarily agreement. I can tell you that I have a patient right now who is like 8 or 9 years old, who was referred to me by a colleague, presented with a lot of anxiety, trouble going to school, but it just but what he really was more than anything was very reactive, spontaneously, for no obvious reason, in all kinds of settings. Even at WaterWiz, he was melting down and needing to go home immediately. But what actually has worked for him are mood stabilizers, whatever you call his diagnosis. And again, I'm very reluctant to make a diagnosis of bipolar disorder in childhood. The only medicines that actually worked for him was taking him off SSRIs that had been prescribed for presumed anxiety, and treating him with mood stabilizers, which are classically the treatment for bipolar disorder. So it's a
But we're not,
real, it's a huge spectrum.
but we're not using the medications. Oh, these medications work, and therefore we're going to diagnose you retroactively with bipolar
Correct.
disorder, right? Because the medications, the mood stabilizers, are not designed for bipolar disorder. They happen to work often well for bipolar disorder, but they're actually designed for epilepsy mostly, right? They're
Some of them.
anti-epileptics,
Well,
some of them.
I wouldn't say they were designed for that, but
Okay, they're
that
used
was
for
their
their
original, that was
that's
their
their
original
original
use.
use. Yeah, so right, so I think that maybe what we can say in that example is that, like, we don't know the source of her mood deregulation and her reactivity, and this class of drugs
That's
works
right.
well.
I consider the single most important question to ask patients or people or their friends or family members, regardless of their age, is when this person walks in the room, do you feel like you don't know which person's going to show up? And to me, if the answer to that is yeah, I mean, like, yeah, it could be any one of two or three different people that I know who inhabit this body. That's to me a very important kind of sign that you need to pursue something. That's why I refer to this as unstable mood spectrum, you know, unstable mood disorder.
But again, Jonathan, then how do you distinguish that from DID, dissociative identity disorder, or borderline personality disorder, which is arguably a dissociative disease? Like, I think that all I find I don't diagnose. I mean, I try really hard not to diagnose. Well, now I don't, but because I just found over and over again, the more you know someone, the harder it is to diagnose them. That we have
dissociation is not a common feature at all in bipolar disorder of any stripe.
Borderline disorder has dissociative features.
Well, I thought you said both. I thought you said DID or borderline.
No, you said if somebody comes in the room and you don't know who's going to walk in the room. So that could be.
I mean, in terms of like, you know, coming in, being happy and cheerful and kind and so on, as opposed to coming in and feeling glum and down and bummed out. I didn't mean like really that they're, you know, cross-dressing or looking like a completely different person, like you don't even know their name. I just meant in terms of just the manner, their manner and demeanor when they walk across the threshold.
So this is, I'm seriously asking you this, how you differentiate between, and Lisa and Mark, how do you differentiate? How do you make the differential diagnosis between borderline personality disorder and bipolar disorder? Because in my experience, they can look so similar.
I find in borderline personality disorder, there are certain key features that you don't typically see in mood disorders, like
splitting.
The inability to ever feel that there's enough, that's tending to see everything in black or white, all or nothing terms. Mm-hmm. Some of these, and I think, you know, Mark and Lisa may have other thoughts, but there are certain key fundamental properties of borderline personality that you wouldn't typically see in a mood disorder.
It's a mixture of all sorts of features that you kind of add it up, you put it through a filter, and you come up with a diagnosis that will justify and allow you to treat what you know is going to work, or you have a high suspicion is going to work, and it might be mood stabilizers as opposed to antidepressants, because they can hurt. They can agitate somebody. If you give an antidepressant in the absence of a mood stabilizer, or if you treat ADHD in the absence of a mood stabilizer, they're going to get worse. They're going to get agitated and made more unstable. If you do it with a mood stabilizer established first, then you can get away with it and treat the attention symptoms, for instance, without agitating the individual. It's important to have a diagnosis. The other feature is inheritance. Ask about relatives with unstable mood problems. That's not going to differentiate. You know, it's not going to sway you one way or the other, but it will have an important thing, because bipolar disorder is inheritable. Probably borderline personality disorder is more related to early parenting. It can be inheritable too, but it's probably related to early rejection.
I'm going to stop right there for a second because we're way over our break time. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing bipolar disorder this morning with social worker Jenny Putnam, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and neuroscientist and author Lisa Genova. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we're talking a little bit about how it's diagnosed and some of these medications that are used to treat it. And medications that treat bipolar can have some really unpleasant side effects. And I think, Lisa, one of the things I love about all of your books, we really get to kind of see what it's like to live with some of these, mental illness or neurological disorders. But in that book, we really see how Maddie struggles with that. And I think a lot of us have known, we're like, well, what do you mean they're off their meds? Why would they be off their meds, right? Because it can be really unpleasant. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Yeah, so one of the things that came up over and over when I was doing the research for the book and getting to know people who live with bipolar disorder and their loved ones is the journey of accepting that this is real and that this is something that they can learn to live with, but it's tricky. It's not the same as being diagnosed with, say, diabetes, where like we have the definitive test to show that you know this is you know your insulin isn't working properly or isn't made in your body, and here's what you do. Here's the drug dose. It's gonna work, and like that's what you do. So with bipolar disorder, again, it's say you've had a manic episode, you've never had one before, you've maybe like not been sleeping for weeks leading up to it, you've been a behaving erratically, you know, maybe spending thousands of dollars you don't have, having sexual partners with multiple people when you're in a monogamous relationship, you're behaving in a way that's so out of character for you historically, and you end up in an ER or you have a stay in a hospital for a while, and you've been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and here's your medication. It's lithium, it's mood stabilizers, it's some combination, and you're sent home. And maybe it's been 6 months, and you haven't had another manic episode. And maybe after the depression that followed that manic episode, you haven't been depressed since. It's the meds might actually be working really well for you, but you're also saddled with a significant amount of weight gain. Maybe you've gained 30 pounds. You've got a hand tremor that people look at you funny, like, what's wrong with her? Or maybe it's like not allowing you to do what you like to do. Like you're a painter or you're a photographer and your hands are shaky. You're always thirsty. You always have to pee. You've got acne. You're cognitively foggy. You're having a hard time thinking clearly. You're just feeling a little bit lethargic. So 6 months go by and you're thinking, other than all these symptoms, I feel normal. And the symptoms I'm dealing with seem worse than whatever went down back in, 6 months ago. And like maybe I just was that really bipolar disorder? Maybe it was just a one-time thing. I was really stressed out. I wasn't sleeping at all. Maybe it was just a result of lack of sleep, for goodness sake. And so people try the experiment of going
Sure.
off the meds because it feels like a very reasonable thing to do when you listen to people talk about the experience. It's really tough to cope with a lot of those symptoms. And so people start to wonder, are the side effects of the meds worse than the symptoms of this condition? And so they try the experiment, and what happens is people do end up living through another manic episode that might be worse than the first one, and then they go into another depression that's often worse than any of the depressions they've had before. They tend to get more extreme over time when unmanaged. And so I equate it to like not having lived this. It's like I've had three children. Like that women sign up to do that again and again. Like we forget how painful it is. We forget how inconvenient it all was, and we're like, I'll do that again. So I think that there's I think it just is very humanizing to understand that it's difficult to stay on these meds, and it's reasonable for people to try the experiment of, can I go off these safely?
And again, at the beginning, mania feels really good. It feels like, wow, I can get so much done. I know someone who would repaint the interior of her entire house when she was on a manic episode, and she would feel like, look what I got done, until she was like, stop painting mid-room, and that was it. And paint cans were in the room for a month after that, right? But at the beginning, it feels really,
Beginning.
really good.
Yeah, if you could just stay at that beginning, right? That
Right.
hypomanic, like that on ramp, people talk about, like, I got so much done. And if you have any kind of talent for anything, like if you are a painter or a writer or some kind of creative person, and you have that extra boost in energy, and also like that you can do no wrong, right?
Yeah.
Like you had all of the barriers and all of the editors and judgment in your head that keep you safe and small are gone. The
Yep.
guardrails are off, and so it does feel great until it gets out of control.
What about the stigma attached to it? There's something, and I pulled this quote from Lisa when we talked about your book last time because I just thought this was so great. You write, "The language of this illness is a curious thing. Some people will say she has bipolar, while others will say she
She
is
is
bipolar.
bipolar.
It's a subtle distinction in wording, a linguistic sleight of hand, but the difference in meaning feels significant." That is so true.
Yeah, over and over, people talked about this. And it's interesting, right? It's like mental illness sort of carries this distinction, what we call mental illness, and it's just an arbitrary categorization. With other brain illnesses, like we don't say I am Alzheimer's or I am Parkinson's or I am a traumatic brain injury, but we do say, or we might say, I am bipolar, I am depressed, I am schizophrenic. So that collapse in identity can be harmful, especially, with bipolar disorder, where this tip the average age of onset is late teens, early 20s, when you're just starting to figure out your identity and who am I beyond the opinions and rules of the house I was brought up in. And now you've got this diagnosis, which is basically, it's so huge and chaotic, and it's basically saying, here, this is who you are bipolar. And so that can leave little room for discovering what else you are. And so I think it's important to recognize that it's part of who you are, but not the sum total. Because then people will write you off and judge you like, oh, she's bipolar. And then there's this massive amount of distrust and fear and dismissiveness that can happen and not allow for being witness to and uncovering and seeing all of the other parts of this human that's in
I
front of
think
you.
that part of the complication is that all of these things, depression, bipolar, mania, whatever, are affect our ability to socialize. And our identity is formed so much through our interactions with other people. And so I think saying, for some people, saying I'm bipolar is saying, give me some space. I think it is part of who I, it is part of who I am, but also I think it becomes more central to who you are because that part of you dictates how people are reacting to you.
I think that when people refer to themselves or other people as being bipolar, they're often really saying, gee, you just never know about that person. In other words, it's not so much in a clinical sense as it is in a kind of descriptive, non-professional way to kind of describe an acquaintance's or family member's personality. Okay. I mean, I see that, at least I see that often.
What, Jenny, what about the stigma? You grew up with a sister just a couple years older than you, and did you see that stigma as, what once?
Absolutely. I mean, a couple of things come to mind. One is we went to Falmouth Academy, which people here know, when it was just starting, and it was a very, very small school, and people did not know that we were related to each other. We came to school together every day. We left together every day. We had the same last name, but people did not realize we were related because she was so odd, and I was reasonably normal. And it was so hard to be her sister because I was embarrassed by her often, but I also was very protective of her. People would say horrible things about her, and on the one hand, I would want to be like, yeah, and on the other hand, I would want to be like, well, she's Linny. Can we love her anyway? And so, yeah, the stigma is real. And again, I think this is part of why people say I am bipolar, to sort of explain to themselves why people treat them the way they do. And so people become more and more isolated, at least my sister did. And all the people, I know a number of people who have siblings who had bipolar disorder, and they all have this same situation where they're kind of the sibling often becomes like the lifeline to social life, where you have to help them be part of something so they don't become so isolated. Or you cut
But
them
don't.
off because it's too difficult. I mean, I've seen that as well.
Well, don't forget the person still has agency. They still were a person before they got these symptoms and had this label. They still have agency even with the condition. They have agency over the condition.
I think
That's.
that when you're in a manic episode, it's hard to say
Oh,
that you have
okay.
agency in the same way that we think about having agency.
No, that you're right. Of course. I'm talking about the stigma aspect of it and the ongoing daily. I think a successful treatment with an individual would be a change from I am bipolar, an interchange. I am bipolar to I have this experience, this vulnerability, and I manage it the best I can. That's agency. And the
That's the
state that I
dream.
am bipolar, well, it's the successful outcome of
I mean,
treatment that happens.
I would say I'm just sort of, you can see right now that I'm feeling that exact way where I'm feeling like protective of her, right? So she struggles with that. My sister is the best medicated she's ever been, 63 years old. She didn't start being medicated until she was well into her 30s, but she has tattooed on her hand, on her arm right here, "I am enough," because she needs that
Okay, there
reminder
you go.
all the time.
Oh, I love
There you
that.
go. Good. Good.
Well,
Well, she's made a good treatment. That's a good outcome.
but we live in a society that it's like a vicious circle, right? Like, so we live in a society that still doesn't understand bipolar disorder well. Right, we're not far enough along in this conversation that we're having right now, where people feel familiar with it enough to not look at your sister when she was younger, or people who have this and are behaving strangely, and think, "I don't understand what that is. That's weird, or that makes me super uncomfortable. So I'm gonna otherize that person. I'm gonna look away. I'm not gonna deal with that. I can't trust that person. Oh, it's bipolar disorder," and just write you off. So, we saw this with cancer. We've seen this with Alzheimer's. I mean, that's been my world for a long time, dealing with that. And it was very much closeted and so much stigma and shame and isolation and alienation. And so I've seen the power of what conversation and story and humanizing can do to bring people back into belonging and to like, okay, this is going on, but I don't have to look away now. I don't have to be afraid of what's going
That's
on
right.
with you. So I'm hopeful that as much I'm as hopeful that as much as we'll see improvements in medications that are more specific for bipolar and that will really help people be less deal with less side effects and be more effective for keeping their mood and energy and sleep stable, I am as optimistic that these conversations are going to help people feel like they can belong with bipolar disorder, that they don't have to be excluded from humanity because they have this. Their humanness is still worthy of belonging. I love that tattoo, Barry.
But I treat a lot of people with bipolar disorder who are very so they got bipolar disorder. Other people have other things. Everybody's got issues. I mean, there's millions of people with bipolar disorder who live really quite normal lives, in the same way that there's millions of people with diabetes who live quite normal lives. I mean, is it, Lisa, is it, as when you did your research, I mean, was it your experience that it was more typical than not that people with bipolar disorder are kind of separate from society, or,
It was my experience that all of these people were in different stages of living with the illness. So some people are newly diagnosed and sort of the earth beneath them feels very like unstable, like I don't have a footing in this yet. Like it's questions of identity. Who am I now? Can I trust myself? Am I allowed to seek out a life partner? Am I allowed to have big dreams with this? To people who have lived with it for decades and decades and like feel super confident and have big jobs and are okay and in relationships. So it spans based on like how long they've been in this, but everyone talked about going through like now even my closest family members, some of them don't want to admit that this is what I have, won't speak about it. There's so much stigma attached to this that there's shame. So the secrecy breeds the shame. Like, oh, we can't talk about this. People might judge you. So it's, yeah, I think people do deal with like, how does this change how the world sees me? And it does change how the world sees you. I don't think we're there where people are totally accepting of this yet.
866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about bipolar disorder this morning with social worker Jenny Putnam, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and neuroscientist and author Lisa Genova. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Lizzie is calling us from Sandwich. Good morning.
Good morning. I would like to find out, after a patient is diagnosed as bipolar disorder, and medication was prescribed, Is there any other strategy would be implemented to the treatment, like any other holistic treatment included?
That is such a great question, as always. I'm going to let Lisa answer this, but I know there is.
Oh, I'm happy to, but do one of the psychiatrists want to talk about what? I mean, I'm happy
Okay.
to, I just don't want to step on toes here.
You wouldn't be stepping on toes because it's information that everybody should be at least exposed to. The point is, nothing is proven, I guess. Really, you can say like you were using the example of diabetes. It's not insulin to diabetes. There's no insulin. But there are things that help. And the history of major mental illness, the road is scattered with promises broken for things happening, for things being effective. So, as a matter of fact, I was reading there's three psychiatric conditions that have the most stigma: bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, and then schizophrenia. Those were the three big hitters, so to speak, in terms of stigma and the ew factor. Yeah, I don't want to touch this factor.
I guess,
Okay, so
I would say that as far as, approaches and strategies other than medication, certainly is kind of keystone of treating bipolar. I spend a lot of time talking with patients about the importance, and this is a generic conversation that applies to everybody all the time, regardless of whether you have any diagnosis or not, is the importance of good nutrition, regular exercise, and a good night's sleep on a regular basis,
that's
because we
right.
know those are the three things that everybody can do, whether they have a label on them or not, to be healthy and to reduce the risk of serious chronic illnesses later on in life.
And
So,
add,
and this is true for ADHD, which I know Lisa is currently, doing a lot of research on. It's true for people with anxiety disorders. I guess I often throw in a strong plea for people to learn meditation, but I have no reason to think that's specifically helpful for bipolar disorder. It's probably the most potent treatment in my experience for ADHD. The reality is that most of us are not really terribly healthy in terms of our daily habits. And if we live in a healthier way, we'd all be healthier.
Sure.
So
I would add avoid alcohol and drugs to your list
Oh,
there.
don't say that.
Well, if you've got this impairment in your ability to regulate mood, so you don't, and you're being medicated, you don't want to take anything that's a stimulant or a depressant that's going to maybe wobble you one way or the other. So yeah, there is this usually agreement like to not take stimulants and depressants, so alcohol and other drugs. But in addition to that, treatment is tends to work best when it's seen as a collaboration between your physician, hopefully also a therapist, and your family members or village of people around you who are in on this and can be your eyes and ears, because sometimes you're not the best witness to your change in behavior, and your mom or your sister or someone might be available to say, like, hey, I am noticing the following. And that is your sign to be in touch with the doctor and say, okay, so I've started sleeping less, or I'm talking really fast, or I'm not getting out of bed. I'm hitting another depression. So it's tracking your mood. So like a lot of people will use something called a mood tracker. Either it's an app or just a daily list of questions that are good for you. Like, how many hours of sleep did I get last night? What was my mood this morning, last night? What did I eat today? What are my thought? How anxious am I today on a scale from 1 to 10? So am I? If you have sort of like, if I start talking a lot about Taylor Swift, like that was in the book, if there's something that like I get super excited about when I start to become hypomanic and I can't stop talking about or thinking about, like, am I starting to talk about that? So just tracking what's going on day to day, so you actually have your own set of data to notice, oh, I'm drifting toward mania, or I'm drifting toward depression, so you can get ahead of it before it gets too big. So
One
that's
of the great.
safety.
In this country, there hasn't really been much in the way of the what's called the recovery movement. In this country, the only example that we have of that is AA, which is really the original peer support recovery movement. But in other countries, whether it's borderline personality, schizophrenia, bipolar, the peer support has been much more successful. And that certainly is something
Yeah.
that I wish that we had more available to us in this
Yeah,
country.
that makes so
Yeah,
much sense.
there might
Yeah.
be support through NAMI of Cape Cod, NAMI, or NAMI Massachusetts, and also the International Bipolar Foundation, I know, has support groups.
Yeah. One of the things I meant, another thing in the book, we really get to go through Maddie's journey, and I found it interesting that I could identify with Maddie's experiences and feel that empathy for her struggle, but I could equally feel that same empathy for her mother. Right? Because as we're talking, we sort of touched on this also impacts the family. And when you're talking about that person who can, check in and have, her mom was really trying to do that all along, right?
Yeah. And it's hard because, again, it's if you're talking about someone who's the beginning of this, so late teens, early 20s, it's a natural phase of life to stop listening to your parents and to find it intrusive and controlling and micromanaging. And yet that's now mom's like instinct is to like, how do I keep you safe? So it's this push pull of like in a young person's life of like, I need to be kept safe as now because I have bipolar disorder, but also I need to be given permission to explore and take chances and find and discover, who I am and what I want to do in life. So it's very tricky and it's hard on the relationships. It's a new dance. It's a new relationship people have to find their footing in.
Right. Dan, do we have a phone call? No, okay. There's also triggers, right? And that might be another area that family can help you with. Like I think you mentioned, like in the book, her fascination with Taylor Swift. That might be a trigger that family's going, okay, wait a minute, what's happening here? But there's different triggers for different people, right? I mean, and
Yeah,
that's not
some of them
unusual.
can be specific to certain people, like some might be gambling or driving cars, like liking wanting to purchase new cars. But a lot, a sort of a through line for everyone, it really is sleep. It is if you are noticing that, like oh, I have a transatlantic flight, and I'm going to switch time zones, and I'm going to not have a good night's sleep. Like that might be enough of a trigger to send you into a manic episode. So a loss of sleep for that it's imposed on you for some reason. Like if you know this is about to happen, like, hey, I have a job that I have to stay, I'm up till midnight and I normally go to bed at 9. Like let your village of people know, like this is I or what can you do to mitigate what could be the effects of that? Like, okay, I'm gonna take a nap that day. I'm gonna like make sure I get a good night's sleep the next night. I'm gonna monitor it with my mood tracker and make sure like I'm getting good night's sleep. If it starts to go off the rails, then we can again, as a village, let our physician know and like see if we can get ahead of it.
It, keeping in mind with
Yeah.
that, I think that it's important to remember for the individual and the family member and the extended community that all of that is a lot of work. And so when we get frustrated and tired sometimes, when sometimes we don't take the medication or we don't track our mood, that's
Yeah.
okay. That you
Yeah.
say it's, you say like, okay, I got off of it. I need to get back on it. It's okay. This is how humans behave. I'm a human. It's okay.
All right. Social worker Jenny Putnam, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and neuroscientist and author Lisa Genova. Her latest book focuses on bipolar. It is More or Less Maddie. Highly recommend it. Thank you all for being here this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.